Well, thank you very much for inviting me to this meeting. I'm a diagnostic radiologist, and when I am not taking care of patients, I have a research program that involves developing new imaging technologies. And what I'm going to tell you about today is a new technology that we've been working on for about the last 10 years that's focused on imaging quantitatively the elastic properties, the mechanical properties of tissue. And so what you see here is a quantitative image of the brain in cross-section on a color scale showing the shear stiffness predicted by this technique in brain tissue in kilopascals. And so in the next few minutes, what I'd like to do is to cover a little bit of how we do that kind of imaging, how we are able to do that, and then potentially, given what I understand to be the interest here, the potential applications in neuroscience, including biomechanical modeling. This is going to be quite speculative, so the Mayo Clinic lawyers have asked if you'd read this carefully before we proceed. So the motivation behind this work was not initially to measure brain material properties. It was that we know that in clinical medicine, the technique called palpation is an extremely powerful tool for detecting pathology. And every medical student learns that a hard mass in the thyroid, breast, and prostate is very likely to be cancer. Turns out that that's probably a very, very valuable tissue property to image somehow, so the motivation of this was to detect cancer to start with. However, it turns out that probably the first applications in clinical practice will not be in that area. How do we image elasticity of tissue? Well, any engineer would tell you that you could take a static or quasi-static approach where we apply a force, we measure the strain, and then the elastic modulus is just the ratio between those. And there are ways in imaging to establish fiducials in an object, then you could in principle squeeze it down with a known force on the outside and then measure the strain of each little tissue element and then go back somehow and calculate what the elastic properties must be. The big problem with that is that you don't know the distribution of stress throughout the object. You don't know. You only know the stress you applied on the outside, so you don't know the stress throughout. So it's always been known that an alternative to this would be to apply dynamic stress, mechanical waves, propagating mechanical waves. And if you could somehow image those propagating waves within the material, then by using continuum mechanics, you could calculate the elastic properties based on the wavelength and other parameters. The problem, of course, is that propagating waves in materials displace the material only a tiny amount, a micron or a fraction of a micron. How in the world would we measure this? So we worked on this a number of years ago and actually came up with a technique. MRI is remarkably versatile, and a variation of the phase contrast technique that you heard described in the first lecture here today is what we use. And we published this a few years ago, and these are actually waves of less than a micron in amplitude depicted with this imaging technique within a tissue simulating phantom. So the way this technique works, and I'm showing it here with a tissue simulating phantom made of a gel material with some stiff inclusions within it, is we apply these mechanical waves. They are shear waves. They are not ultrasound. They are in low frequency. They're in the audio frequency range. And then we image them with this special phase contrast technique that has a trick in it that allows it to image these waves, even though they have very low amplitude, on the order of microns. In fact, in vivo, we can image waves with amplitudes on the order of tens of nanometers, less than the wavelength of light, in vivo, in the presence of physiologic motion with this technique. We image those waves, and then it comes down to something that is very important in this building, mathematics, an inversion process to take this these data and compute from that the elastic properties of materials. When we started this work a little bit more than a decade ago, really the mathematics really didn't exist for this particular type of inversion process. We've come a long way since then, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. But this shows you that quantitatively the elasticity of this tissue simulating gel material here. You can see the background is around 20 kilopascals. We can apply shear waves with a single driver. We can apply them with multiple drivers. We can do phased arrays. There's all kinds of possibilities. We can use all kinds of different technologies for inducing these waves. In MR imaging, so far I've been showing you just single slice images where we've been encoding for motion in just one direction, but I have shown you multiple phases in the wave cycle, and we can do that by just manipulating the imaging parameters, but you can see that we can generalize this to image in three dimensions in space, at each point in space to image the motion of each particle in X, Y, and Z. Again, at the level of microns, it's not appreciable motion that you could see in an image that you can image in multiple times. Essentially, it's seven-dimensional imaging that's possible to generate the data for this. We come then to the mathematics, the inversion process that takes these wave images and converts them into something that represents the elastic properties. The human mind, I've learned, is just not designed to interpret wave images and do this inversion. Can anyone, and I expect any place I've ever shown this picture, I expect this audience to be able to invert this image and tell me the pattern of stiffness and softness that represents that this wave field represents. Can anybody tell me that hasn't seen this before? I didn't think so. Okay? So there are various ways we can approach the inversion. The simplest of all is just a simple measurement of wavelength with a simple relationship between the elastic properties, the frequency of the wavelength, and the density of the material, which in the case of soft tissues are all very close to that of water, and we just ignore that variation for most situations. And so there are a variety of my colleague, Dr. Armando Manduca, who's a mathematician, a biomathematician, has been working in this area for 10 years and has developed a number of different inversion techniques. The first one that was successful, and we still use it a lot, is based on a simple image processing technique where there are spatial filters that determine the local spatial frequency in the images, and that turns out to be very helpful. Direct inversion of the wave equation in various forms, and then there are people working on finite element based inversions as well, so there's all kinds of possibilities. One of the things we find very useful in all of these inversions is something we call directional filtering. This is a very rich data set, and we can not only filter frequency in space, we can filter through time. So here we have a situation where we have a phantom with stiff objects here, waves propagating down. You can see how the wave gets longer as these waves propagate through this, but you can see there's some jittering here that's present because the waves are bouncing off the bottom of this container, propagating up, and we're getting interference between the down propagating wave and the up propagating wave. But because this data set is so, these data sets are so rich, we can actually filter these using spatial temporal filters, and here we can filter out just the waves that are propagating down, and here you can see these are the waves that are propagating up, reflecting off the bottom, and also coming off of, through diffraction effects, coming off these inclusions. And this turns out to be very useful in our inversions. This is the same data again. If you just apply a direct inversion to it, we get some of these shadowing effects and other problems here, and you can see how we get an improvement in the inversion when we use directional filtering plus some kind of an inversion process. It's just to say there's a lot of work to do in that area. Applications. So I'm going to focus on the brain, apply how do you work, do this on the brain, and show you what so far we've been able to do to see whether or not this is of interest to you. The thing I can tell you now that I couldn't have told you a year ago is that, you know, we've been looking at many, many applications, and we have people exploring all of these, and it's not just our group now that's looking at this. We're here to talk about the brain, but the thing I can tell you today is that there is an application in the liver that turns out to be so compelling it's going to change the practice of medicine. I'm absolutely certain about that, and therefore I'm going to just show you how that works just so you know why it's probably going to be available in your local medical institution. I think within a year or two, most scanners, I think, are going to have this technology available because this is such a compelling application. So we're here to talk about brains, but give me 2 minutes to talk about the liver, if you don't mind, because it's just such an important point. Common problem, a very common disease on a worldwide basis is something called liver fibrosis. It's the stereotype way that the liver responds to any type of insult. There are over 100 million people in the world that, for one reason or another, are very likely to be developing 25% chance of developing liver fibrosis. And right now, we would like to make that diagnosis before it progresses to cirrhosis, which is irreversible, can't be stopped, can't be reversed. The only treatment is liver transplant. Right now, the only diagnostic technique for diagnosing liver fibrosis is liver biopsy. It's an invasive technique. There are no imaging tests that we have routinely available to us that can make this diagnosis. It's invasive, it's painful, it's not very accurate, so there's a tremendous need for a non-invasive technique. And this just shows you then how MR elastography can be used for that. The liver, normal liver, is one of the softest tissues in the body, probably like the brain, and a cirrhotic liver is rock hard. So the intermediate grades of fibrosis just have a range of stiffness. This is the liver here, you can see. We put mechanical waves in with this technique, in this case at 60 hertz. Here are the waves imaged within the liver and spleen, and you can see this acquisition is on the order of 20 to 40 seconds long. There is the elastogram, which shows the normal liver, which in this normal volunteer has a stiffness of about 2 kilopascals. That's about the same as subcutaneous fat. Normal is less than 3 kilopascals. Here's another patient. There's nothing about this liver here that would suggest that there's liver fibrosis. Here are the waves. And I can already tell by looking at these waves that they're longer than they should be, but here's the inversion, which shows a very much higher stiffness in the liver on the order of 6 kilopascals and tremendous heterogeneity as well. This is bears out in clinical trials. This is grading of fibrosis, and these are normals. These are all patients with different grades of biopsy-proven fibrosis. It's got a very high sensitivity and specificity, almost unheard of in measurements that we take in medicine to have that kind of level of diagnostic accuracy. So this is going to be something that's going to be at an institution near you soon. So, yes? In the diagnosis of any degree of liver fibrosis, it's 99% sensitive. That is, it's in fact greater than that. In other words, there's almost no one. If you did this test and you had, let's say, have an elevated liver enzyme, your doctor's worried that you might be developing liver fibrosis. If you have this test and you have a stiffness in your liver that's within the normal range, less than 3 kilopascals, it's 99% likely that you do not have liver fibrosis. That's a very high degree of sensitivity. And the specificity is also very high at 98%, meaning that there are very few false positives. Well, you know, the initial development of this technology was focused on the idea of detecting cancer, and the applications in breast imaging, and actually in liver are going to be very interesting, but those, we already do a good job on focal disease in those structures. It's really the diffuse diseases, including the brain, that we don't do such a good job on, and that's where we're focusing right now. Yes, these are done in a breath hold, absolutely. A series of 3 breath holds in this particular case. So as I pointed out already, we've been exploring 2 areas in the application in the brain. One is in diffuse disease, because we already do a good job on detecting brain tumors and so on, but diffuse disease we don't necessarily do such a good job on. And then we've also explored, because we've been encouraged by some investigators, to explore using this technology to look at the pathomechanics of traumatic brain injury. Of course, I've been told all along by my colleagues in neuroradiology that there is a lot of potential interest in making measurements of brain material properties and other things in the whole area of biomechanical modeling of hydrocephalus. Some of the hypotheses that normal pressure hydrocephalus is in fact maybe the etiology is based on a change in brain material properties. And then finally, the whole area of biomechanical modeling of the brain for surgical simulation. There's a demand for having reasonable values of brain elastic properties. So, I'm going to focus, as I say, our group has focused on these 2 areas, diagnosis and traumatic injury, but I think that, so that's what I'll show you. How do we generate shear waves inside the brain? It's surrounded by this rigid box, so how in the world are we going to generate shear waves? Well, it turns out there's nice inertial effects that take place when you shake the head. And if you shake the head at a very small rate, much less than the amount of shaking that I got in the taxi from the airport yesterday, I can tell you. We can generate adequate shear waves to image. And so I'm going to show you that. This is one of the first images. This is actually one of the physicists that I work with, and this is his brain. And here you see the waves propagating just from I think it was an 80 hertz oscillation. Here we did a rendering of a slice showing the waves magnified, of course, about 1,000 times in amplitude. But I think you get the idea here that the wavelength in the superficial areas, the gray matter, is perhaps a little bit shorter than the wavelength in the deeper areas, the white matter, and we'll come back to that. The resolution is the same as for MRI in terms of the basic image, so whatever it would be, a millimeter or so typically, and pixel size. Now, of course, to measure accurately a region, to measure the stiffness accurately, you probably need a bigger area than just than a pixel, than a volume element. So, and that, and in some ways, it relates to the wavelength of the applied. It's not limited only by the wavelength, because this is a coherent imaging modality, not an incoherent modality. But it's probably like a fraction of the wavelength. Typical wavelengths are on the order of a centimeter or so. So you could think of being able to accurately measure something that's maybe a half centimeter in diameter. You can detect something that's stiff that's a lot smaller. You can detect it, but you may not be able to measure it accurately. This is that same image that I showed earlier, but again, now you can see how these images seem to show that the gray matter is softer than white matter, and I'll come back to some quantitative measurements on that. We had no idea what to expect in this, but our real main thrust is in this work, and we're funded by the NIH to do a study to look at a hypothesis as to whether or not looking at brain material properties will help us diagnose diffuse brain disease, particularly neurodegenerative disease, where you get this accumulation of beta amyloid plaque, which could well change the mechanical properties of brain tissue because of the presence of this material. So that's kind of what we're pursuing right now. But we, as I've been making these presentations, I've had people come up to me and say, yep, I completely agree with you that gray matter is softer than white matter, and I've had other people just pound on the table and say it's absolutely not the case that white matter is softer than gray matter. We went to the literature, and of course there's a huge range in estimates of the shear modulus of brain tissue, but they don't agree on whether gray matter is softer than white matter or stiffer than white matter. And that's what we get from the literature. Our data would suggest this. This is based on a series of 20 volunteers, that white matter is significantly stiffer than gray matter, but that's what the results we have so far. The same data on the individual volunteers that we imaged in age range from about 20 all the way up to about 80 years of age. And I was kind of hoping we'd see some kind of trend in brain stiffness or brain elasticity with age, but so far we haven't seen that. It's a tremendously important point. So the question was, so far all of these models, the inversion model we're using is a linear isotropic model for, and of course, and completely elastic, so not viscoelastic. So in white matter, it's very likely that we're going to see anisotropic wave propagation behavior. We see it in muscle, and that's a whole area for us to explore, but so far we haven't scratch the surface of that. It would be interesting, for instance, if we could analyze the wave images in white matter and actually deduce the direction of fiber orientation, which would then be another way to do fiber tracking. And so there's all kinds of, yes?
When you look at a normal, the difference, say, between gray and white matter, mm-hmm. and the hydrocephalic thing, is there
We don't know the answer to that. We've done very little pathology. We've done a few focal lesions. We're focused on doing patients with cognitive impairment, and that means that we have to develop this technique to a point where it's extremely fast, very robust. We're still not quite there yet to do that trial, so we're working on that. Yes? Yeah. I wish I could answer that question, it's been a long time since I organized these data, and I don't recall making that observation at the time. I think all of these are very large strains compared to the kind of strains we're using, which of course are on the level of microns. and they are all typically at much lower frequencies, of course, or static, compared with what we're doing, which is at a frequency of like 10 or 20 hertz. So there are differences, and they need to be explored. Yeah, well, I think that there is definitely is some of that coming in here as well. I mean, we tend to call it shear stiffness as opposed to shear modulus, because we are saying that there could be an element of viscosity in the measurement that's contributing to the stiffness that we're observing. So we're looking at a much more dynamic measurement than any of these mostly static measurements. And these are done with typically inflating balloons and things like that. I mean, and so I think that there's. But the point is that this availability of a dynamic technique like this hasn't been available before. And really, if you think about it, you can't take out brain tissue and go and put it on a dynamic mechanical analyzer, because without perfusion, metabolism, and preloading, what does that mean?
Yes. Don Ingber at Harvard. Works in mechanobiology, and he points out that living organized tissue in vivo has enormously different mechanical properties than dead ground tissue.
Yep.
Yeah,
not only that, but there's a phenomenon called mechanotransduction, actually, which modulates gene expression based on the mechanical environment. We're actually starting to understand that that's, in fact, one of the contributors to liver, for instance, liver fibrosis, is actually the stiff environment. It actually changes gene expression. Yes, sir?
In your understanding, do you think that if you do the same measurement at low ICP and at high ICP, would you expect differences or not?
I think it's quite possible there might be, because I do know that when we change the preloading in one way or another, there's several ways that can happen, but one is you can take a nonlinear elastic element, and by putting it under different places in the stress-strain curve, and then measure locally the elastic modulus, you're going to get different values. So that's probably the most. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, and there's all kinds of interesting repercussions of that. But we're running out of time. So I'm almost done here. Where are we going technologically with this? I mean, again, I alluded to the fact that we're not quite there. At 1.5 Tesla, it's not quite good enough or fast enough for us to do it reliably on people who might forget what it is they're doing in the space of a 30-second imaging exam. And so we are now going to 3 Tesla, and we are getting much better wave images because of the increased signal-to-noise there. And these are just the two kinds of motion we apply, what we call the nay motion, which is what kind of like going like that, and the yay motion, which is this way. These are very tiny motions, and here you see the SI motion. This is superior inferior, front to back, and then right to left, and these are all encoded. And then the other thing we're doing, of course, is imaging in 3 dimensions, so that all of this. Yes, sir?
Does the propagation direction matter for the wave?
Well, we're measuring, there's several different things that we're talking about here. One is the motion of each particle in space. So as a wave propagates through tissue, you can imagine a particle sitting here, and it's going to go through some kind of probably elliptical or figure eight motion as the wave field propagates through it. So there is the issue of the direction of wave propagation. There is the issue.
For example, in the wide matter, they are like fiber thin. So
yeah.
If you go along those fibers, I imagine that we get a different thickness than
absolutely. It's anisotropic in muscle. We see this phenomenon called that we call a waveguide phenomenon. Muscle is so anisotropic that waves propagate preferentially along the fibers. And we don't see it to quite that extent in the brain, but we think we're starting to see some of that. And I think especially here you can start seeing that we're now with the better signal to noise and the 3D depiction of what's going on, we're starting to see a lot of interesting wave information. I'm going to finish then just quickly with a little bit of just so we're also applying it to look at the biomechanics of diffuse axonal injury, of trauma, brain trauma, and there are people with all kinds of theories on how it is you get particular patterns of lesions after various kinds of energy passing through the brain. You can try to study that with a dummy, but the trouble with a dummy is that it doesn't have a brain, and so you really don't know why you get and how does the energy propagate through the brain. Why do you get these? And so far I've been showing you continuous dynamic stress, but in fact we can also look at a transient dynamic stress. We don't have to apply a continuous waveform. We can apply a single transient impulse, which then propagates through the material. We can image it with the same kind of technology, and then this leads to new kinds of inversions, but also new ways to understand how energy propagates through a complex structure like the brain. And this is just to show you an example. Here we're applying a 50 micron tap, which is a very gentle tap, 37 milliseconds long, and what we're going to do is look at the motion of brain tissue magnified many, many thousands of times here. It's a bit like that, but divided by 1,000, if you will. Okay, and so here we are, and you can see how just incredibly complex the motion of tissue is as this wave of energy propagates through the brain. And here we're showing maximum shear strain propagates through. And from that, you could see how you could go and you could establish models. We can look at, we've measured the strain. Now, this is the maximum strain at each point during as that wave propagates through. We can calculate the elasticity using an inversion on the wave, the transient wave information, and then from that we can multiply the two together to get stress, and this would then allow us to look at the areas where there is highest stress, which might correspond then to the areas where you get injury. It's just so these are the kinds of applications we potentially see with this technique. It's something that's probably going to be available to you in the next couple of years. And the general conclusions are that we can see, and something to keep in mind, we can see these very tiny waves on the order of 100 nanometers in amplitude. They can provide images of the viscoelastic properties, and it's a versatile tool that has a lot of potential probably for both clinical work and possibly for studying physiology. Thanks for your attention. That was my brief.